Anyway, thanks for coming. I want to, first of all, appreciate great appreciation for Michael O'Bannon, who's been doing the video composition and projection today. He made a special stop and came a day or two early for a festival that we both attend, Electronic Music Festival in Upper New York State, to do this. And so I really appreciate his efforts here throughout the evening. So Michael O'Bannon on video. Next of all, Dr. Phil Reed graciously volunteered what he didn't realize was going to be a tremendous amount of time and energy. He's around here somewhere. I just spotted him. There he is. To host this thing and to let us basically take over his space with all these painful chords and technical issues for the evening. And actually, he worked with us throughout the summer doing sound checks in here and figuring out how to do a concert in the planetarium, basically. So the planetarium regularly hosts planetarium shows and laser light shows. As far as I know, this is the first live concert in here. I guess it's been here for a long time, but at least in our tenure, our short, sweet tenure so far, this is the first one. And so he had talked to me a little over a year ago about scoring a planetarium show, and till the end of it, we wound up deciding to do this. My other musical collaborator in this is Jeremy Parson, and so a good bit of what we're doing this evening is an outcome from some independent study that we did over the summer. One reason for doing this is to sort of illustrate that it's available for students who might be interested in doing independent studies or thesis or things like that. It's not enough of a mainline topic, both computer and audio and computer music, to really offer courses in it here. Although the computer audio component of it certainly factors into computer multimedia in general. And so anybody interested in doing any kind of research or independent projects along those lines that's a student here should certainly come and talk to me. We have another student worker here tonight, which is Patrick Wiltrout, who is taking care of the stream. So we're streaming this event onto radio.electro-music.com. I'll have that on a slide later on, so you don't have to keep track of the dots and the dashes. But basically, it's associated with electromusic.com, which is a website forum, also hosts a number of international music festivals. There's one coming up this weekend in Upper New York State, so anybody interested in going to that for a day or two or three can talk to me, and there'll be a little bit about that on the slides. They also host regular radio programs, which now is including this one for this evening. And on the changes of the season, on the equinoxes and solstice, they do what sometimes is as many as 24 hours of around-the-globe music. And so people will basically sign up for slots ahead of time. There's one coming up at the end of June. And so if you go into electromusic.com, you can see where the Autumn Equinox concert's coming up. But it's a very international thing, so every populated continent, every continent except Antarctica, has a presence on the website, and very collaborative and a lot of expertise. And so if you're interested in this, that's another resource. I'm going to do a technical talk, and I'm not sure if we're ready for the switchover. So we'll have to figure out how to feed you a microphone. And actually, are you going to be out here for yours? Okay, so I'll have to dig a cable out. So we may have 5-minute delays between acts here with this. But Dr. O'Bannon is going to walk through my slides. I'll just call him out if that's okay. And I'm not sure where they're going to show up. Oh, there they are. We also have two surprise visitors from the future. So they're going to be playing electro music this weekend up in New York. I'm going to hold off on their announcement until we plug them in closer to the end. But they very graciously offered to come down here and do a duet. And so I took them up on it. And so now they've got the final 30 minutes left for this evening, but I'll hold off on that one. And so here we are. Oh, good, I have a central seat. So I apologize for anybody who's got to crane their neck. But I'm going to try to sort of repeat what's in the slides anyhow so the folks on the radio electro music stream can sort of follow along. So if you have to crane your neck to see the dome in order to look at the slides, I'll just try to make up for that, and you can just close your eyes and relax to the soothing sounds of my voice. Okay, go ahead, Michael. Oh, that's okay. We're doing well tonight. okay, I started this thing off with a dichotomy, and if you deal with electronic musicians, you'll get some of this. If you deal with people outside of computer music, you'll get into some of this too. There are complaints about computer music not being natural or having all sorts of artificial things, like, you know, people by now have gotten overexposed to mechanisms like autotune, and how the computers basically automate everything and they take the life out of it, etc. So I don't know if we've given a decent counterexample of that, but I mean, one of the dichotomies is acoustic versus electronic. Bob Dylan ran into that. Miles Davis ran into that. Another one of the dichotomies then became sort of analog versus digital, and then later on another dichotomy might have been instruments and music that's played by hand on conventional or classical instruments versus making music out of the computer. And the distinctions are all sort of arbitrary and historical and eventually go away. I was actually at a festival, or a conference rather, this summer, International Computer Music Conference, and that conference has a session known as the Unconference. And the Unconference is really a set of discussions by people who may or may not be presenting papers or performing music. A good 50% of that conference consists of compositions in their performance. But the Unconference typically consists of discussion. And we had a number of people in the discussion who have been involved with computer music, you know, most of their adult careers, who were arguing that you really had to have gestures. You had to have gesticulation. So maybe you were playing a conventional instrument like a cello that had electronics hooked up to sense your bowing patterns. Or maybe you had a joystick. One guy from Germany brought his joystick and said, you absolutely have to have something like this. Look at all the degrees of freedom in it. Whereas I was arguing the counterpoint, which is that if you have a concept, then let's say you're doing a performance practice called live coding, where you literally write code live at performance time that controls the output of your software instruments, that's still a gesture. Now, the folks arguing on the other side couldn't see putting a calculation into a piece of software as a physical gesture. But if you consider the fact that all of this stuff that we're doing is embedded in the physical universe, and it's embedded in nature. I mean, where we're at right now is nature's current stage of, you know, evolutionary exploration and experiment on this planet. It's all physical. And so the dichotomies are interesting from a technical point of view, but ultimately I personally feel they don't carry much philosophical or aesthetic weight. And so conventional ones you run into, analog versus digital. This is a little bit of technical stuff. So, you know, if you haven't been exposed to it before, analog, in this case, you have a continuous time-varying voltage transduced by a microphone, which just means that this microphone that I'm talking into converts sound pressure level to voltage, and it varies continuously. When you work with the digital domain, such as computers or just digital circuits in general, you have a discrete time-varying sequence of numbers. So you'll have numbers that describe that sound pressure fluctuation. So that's the distinction there. You have an analog of a physical phenomenon versus a numeric description of a physical phenomenon. But you can still manipulate those things in interesting and creative ways. So that's sort of the distinction between analog and digital. You'll hear some old analog synthesizer purists arguing that the analog synthesizer sounded much better. And that may be a matter of, you know, distortion or just instrument timbre that they preferred in those instruments, which is fine. But fundamentally, the distinction does not necessarily mean that one side or the other of this fence is any better. Acoustic versus electronic is a little bit harder because these things get mixed. I mean, anybody recording acoustic instruments these days is using tons of electronics. They may or may not be intentionally tweaking their signal, but you tweak your signal no matter what. Every time you move into a different acoustic space, your signal changes, the sound changes. Every time you work with a different piece of electronics or software, the sound changes too, and you have to learn how to manipulate that as part of the medium. Okay, so let's go to the next slide. So my point is, it's all real. Real versus virtual. You know, the boundaries change. Social media changes what social interaction is. Virtual reality changes what apparent reality is. You'll have some people arguing that one is more real than the other. This certainly isn't an argument against, you know, physical activity or acoustic instruments or anything. But it's basically sort of a perspective that this stuff is all real and basically consists of phenomena that you can manipulate. One point that I always try to make with my computer science students here, and the last bullet here and this evening really are intent on making this point in spades, is that you should really own these machines. So when you work with computers, some of your work is going to be dictated by software and hardware systems that are already out there. And some of what you do is going to be dictated by your boss or your professor or whomever. But it's possible to take these machines, if you're interested in it, and either by writing software or combining software and combining hardware components, to basically make the machines extension of yourself and do things that you think the machines ought to be able to do. And I think that that is a very good perspective for anyone that's becoming heavily involved in computing, certainly professionally, to take on themselves. It's going to be a source of ideas, and it's also going to be a source of fun, that working with these machines is not going to become a drag if you just consider them to be extensions of yourself. You know, we're already used to extending ourselves with whatever, eyeglasses or acoustic instruments or cars. There's no reason that you can't use the machines the same way. Okay? So, electroacoustic music, I just want to talk real quickly about three ways to manipulate sound, sort of classification hierarchy on this. One mechanism is synthesis. So I have this defined as synthesis as a means for creating sound from the ground up. Analog synthesis uses oscillators that are circuits to generate signals, and then other circuits that will combine those generated signals. Digital synthesis uses algorithms that generate signals, and then they have additional algorithms that modify the descriptions of those signals. And I have a couple of screenshots across the bottom that basically represent different hardware and software synthesizers. The main point about synthesis, which is what a lot of people think about that are outside the field when they hear about electronic music, is that synthesis is only one of the tool sets for manipulating these kind of sounds. Synthesis is a way to create a sound sort of from scratch, except you buy circuits and you use libraries, so you don't really create it from scratch. But you're creating an invented sound. And a lot of electronic musicians do that and consider their main compositional thrust to be sculpting sound. But it's not the only focus, so it's one of three. In the first piece that we played, there was a little bit of synthesis sprinkled in here and there. So at one point I was using a captured sample of the banjo to drive something that sounded like a buzzing clock or a bee or something. Well, I was using the banjo to trigger the timing on that. That particular sound was synthesized. But most of the sounds that we used in that first performance actually were not synthesized sounds at all. So let's go ahead to the next one. Next category, sampled sounds, which is recordings. So some people may be have used tape recorders. I always ask these kind of questions in my Photoshop classes, how many students have used conventional film. More likely you're used to, you know, if you're coming up now recording this stuff on a computer, and again, essentially what you're doing is recording numeric descriptions of sound pressure levels. Once you have that information recorded, you can do lots of things with it. So back in the 80s, the first new instrument technology to follow synthesis consisted of samplers. And those are still around, where essentially the technology was to sample instrument sounds, and you might sample them at different octaves, at different pitch ranges, because the timbre, the flavor, or the tone of the instrument changes as you go up and down the scale. But then to take that information that you had sampled and use that to generate other notes so that, for example, you could play, you know, a sampler keyboard and have it sound like a violin or something, the sound that you were generating was not synthesized. It was originally sampled from an acoustic instrument, and then it was processed to sound as though it had all those pitches and so on available and changes in volume and so on. So that's sort of historical sampling, but you could also just, you know, record entire tracks, which is what we were doing here when we started out, and then you can process those. In the old days of tape delays, you would have people running tape loops. This is how you did looping. And they might run two loops where one ran slightly faster than the other one, and then they would get out of sync, and they actually used that as instrumentation. If anybody has ever run a phonograph record or a tape at the wrong speed, you know that you can accelerate the tempo, but at the cost of shifting the pitch. So if you run it twice as fast, the tempo goes up twice as fast. The recorded sample is over twice as fast, but the pitch doubles. Well, with the signal processing algorithms that are available nowadays, it's possible to independently time stretch a recorded sample and to change the pitch of the recorded sample. So you can time stretch without having the pitch go up or down, so, you know, it goes faster but doesn't sound like Mickey Mouse. And likewise, you can shift the pitch without changing the time. And so we were doing a substantial amount of that. That's actually sort of the backbone of that first piece that we did, was taking sound and manipulating it in two ways. And one of the ways was just to take the sampled sound and do time stretches and pitch shifts on it. And then we can go to the next one. And finally, we have effects processors. So anybody that's been to a rock and roll show for years knows that the the guitar players have a kickbox with tons of hardware effects sitting on the floor. Some of those effects are, most of those effects are probably analog, but more of them are digital these days, and they have processors built in. And then there are also special purpose processing boxes that have digital signal processors, processors designed specifically to process audio. But increasingly, with the amount of power that's available on a laptop, you can do more and more of this stuff in laptop and software. And it's getting to be, to the point where there are laptop artists that go out and just play their laptops. And there are even folks now that are starting to go on tour with basically just an iPad and an amplification system. So the amount of junk you have to carry around has been reduced, although we're not any evidence of that this evening. We certainly got a massive equipment here. So, the examples of the kinds of effects that you can apply, things like filters, so you can get rid of high-pitched signals, get rid of low-pitched signals, knock out pitches in the middle, delays, so you can play a note and have it echo back a quarter note later, and then a quarter note later slightly reduced, and a quarter note later slightly reduced. We were doing some of that. Chorusing is where you take an instrument and basically play back two versions of it, one of them slightly detuned. The idea behind that being when people sing in a chorus, they don't nail exactly the same note all the time, and that's really a good thing, that slight bit of detuning actually puts some texture into what you hear. These are the kind of things, too, that some people legitimately can complain about using facilities like autotune and so on. A certain amount of classical music is based on the fact that you don't have perfect performance or perfect reproduction, and chorusing is an example of that. Reverb, by and large, is a way to try to mimic the acoustic properties of a room as far as having signals bouncing off of walls and so on. Flanging and phasing are two related techniques for doing pitch transformations as you play. Mixing two audio streams. So Jeremy's audio stream, he has a pair, a left and right stereo pair. I have a left and right stereo pair. We've mixed that specifically for the planetarium. We've also mixed it again to stream it out to radioelectromusic.com. And so, in digital, mixing is not a particularly complicated algorithm. Compressing does something similar to what your ear does, makes you more sensitive to low pitches, and tries to compress, or not pitches, but amplitudes, and tries to compress the powerful amplitudes so you don't get basically driven deaf. And then finally, at least for tonight, spatialization, which we're trying to take some advantage of in the planetarium here. Okay? So those are all sort of instrument techniques, synthesis and sampling and effects, but you also have software that can be plugged in at higher levels of abstraction. So some of you here may recognize this as a couple of screenshots from Scrabble to MIDI, which is actually going to show up in our shorter second number. We used the rules of Scrabble and the words that were placed by the Scrabble players, the human Scrabble players, in order to synthesize a composition. Really, it was an improvisation, because it got synthesized at performance time. So depending on what words you put out there and what key you were playing those words in and so on, there's an algorithm that will walk through the board every time you make a move and basically map the sequence of letters into corresponding pitches. And it'll do that at a rate and with tempo and with meter and so on that you can decide in a mapping graphical user interface. So my Java classes and I worked on that for a couple of years. The one that's going to lead us into the second piece tonight actually is something that we haven't performed publicly before, only in the sense that last fall my object-oriented programming class, graduate class, and I put artificial intelligences into this such that they can look through the dictionaries, look at the board, and figure out the best score. So actually when I lead into this tonight, rather than having students play this, student software is going to be playing the game. And I'll do a little bit of music mapping to walk us into it. So they showed it to the trustees a bit last year, but this is actually the debut for the CS520 artificially intelligent Scrabble players to participate in this. I think most of them have graduated, but one or two are still around and I believe here tonight. You can compose with samples, so you can cut and paste samples. The paper I gave at International Computer Music Conference had to do with taking grammars. And for those of you that are taking my CS425 compiler design course, this is a heads up and a lookout, because we're at least going to discuss this paper a little bit. We used grammars, the sort of which you would normally use to process programming languages. And instead, Ryan Panuski, who was a graduate student at the time, and I used it in order to parse and rearrange spoken word samples in order to come up with novel arrangements. You could also do this with instrumental music. So this is sort of the design of a sample-based instrument that exceeds the capabilities of looping, which all of you probably have some exposure to, and certainly after that first number you have exposure to. The instrument's still in kind of rough shape for performing, but the proof of concept is there. And this is something that, you know, somebody interested in doing some additional independent study, there's code to be written. If Ryan hadn't been here, I would have never gotten this thing off the ground because I just did not have enough time to write the code. So that was, you know, an excellent outcome to have one of our graduate students help to co-author a paper that we gave at one of the premier international conferences, actually the premier conference for this discipline. Go ahead. Bless you. Granulation, so there's some of that mixed in there. I found out when Ryan and I were working together that if we chopped the phrases up small enough, we started to granulate the sound. So this is a discipline and a method for doing computer music that really has not started to take hold until computer music has come into shape, because it's necessary to have the time resolution that you have with a computer to basically atomize the sound. I mean, in a sense, what granulation and microsounds has to do with is you're ripping out the atom of sounds and composing with those. And so you can do manipulations with those that, you know, coarse ones just make the sound very grainy. The one rhythmic sound that I had coming off of the banjo at the end was granulated. But it's possible to finesse those until basically you take the original sound of an instrument like banjo, blast it down into its atoms, and then take the atoms and rearrange them into essentially a different instrument that has some sonic properties in common with a banjo, but is probably unrecognizable as a banjo. I wanted to make sure to get this one in, just threw it in. I'm not sure whether we did this or not, because at the last minute I wasn't sure where the center plug was and where the outside plug was. But we got some variation of this. So Grimm is fortunate in having surround sound. So that means that you have five speakers plus a subwoofer. Subwoofer drives the bass signals, and the bass signals are essentially non-directional. So you can, where's the subwoofer at anyhow? It's sitting right back behind the podium? Okay, so back behind the row there? Yeah, we were going to turn that down because we were having some issues at home where we were afraid we were going to drive people nuts. So we forgot to do it, but I guess it didn't happen. There have been studies that have found that if you are consistently exposed to low pitches for a long period of time, that you can start to get depressed. And we were getting depressed, but it actually was sort of nauseating. So we cut the subwoofer back at home. But if we cut it out completely, we lost a really nice dimension to the sound that we wanted to keep. And so part of our agreement was when we get in here, we're going to run those sounds and check them to make sure that we're not going to make anybody sick. But we don't want to lose them completely. So nobody feels nauseous from, like, listening to bass? Okay, so that's good. But the other five signals here are directional. And what was interesting, when we measured with Dr. Reed, Jeremy and I measured back in May, both some of the visual properties of projecting onto the dome for Dr. O'Bannon. But in addition to that, we measured some of the sound properties of how the surround was set up. We found that the speakers were at these angles. So we have what's for us is nominally center at 0 degrees. And then 67 and a half off to that, we have supposedly left back, and then at 112.5 left front, and at 202.5 right front, and at 292.5 right back. Now, if you're on the stream, I'll post the slide so you can take a look at this thing. It looks kind of like a bicycle wheel. And the interesting thing to me is that the speaker placement, they're all at very precise multiples of 22 and a half degrees, which is 1/4 of 90 degrees. But they're asymmetric. And so we came up, we didn't want to do anything too elaborate and fancy because the probability of it working on the first shot without a dry run wasn't great. And so basically we put us where you see us. So Jeremy's left and Jeremy's right are such that if he bounces signals back and forth between a left and right channel, you'll hear the spatial separation. My left and my right likewise are spaced. Looks like I didn't tag. Did I tag my name? I think I'm missing my name on one. Oh, no, there I am at the top. So my right's up at the top and my left is over here. The one out by itself, we put the mono mix, and the other one is the subwoofer. It's not spatial. A couple additional things to say about this. First of all, surround sound wasn't designed for circular spaces, so we had to make this one up as we go. So they're designed for sitting and facing a stage where you have performers and center is in the center and right and left, front are off at precise angles. And rear, left, and right are off at precise angles. Well, everybody's facing a different direction in here, so we sort of made this up as we went along. The other thing that we did, I did an initial diagram when I was off at my conference, and then I came back and Jeremy looked at it and said, well, the mono mix shouldn't be close to anybody else, because if we drop somebody's channel but the mono mix, which is just all four of our channels mixed together, is too close, you're still going to hear it in that location, even though supposedly you backed off that, you know, side left or right. And so that's why the mono's out by itself. And we can go on to the next one from there. Other digital media. So digital audio is sampled for precision in amplitude and frequency. So basically pitch and timbre, what's the instrument sound like, what's the pitch, and how loud is it. Digital image, if you're one of my Photoshop students, is measured in terms of how many pixels per inch and how many bits of color information per pixel. And so in a sense, in manipulating all this stuff, we're looking at a cross product of a multi-dimensional matrix of descriptions. I mean, this stuff's all being done in digital right now. So we're involved in both video and audio in this. And so that's essentially what it is, a multi-dimensional set of descriptions that we're manipulating when we perform. Okay? Okay, so almost last but not least, it looks like I've got a... Let's see if I boost it here. I don't want to get feedback. What's that? Yeah, maybe that. Yeah, that's what it was, actually. I was talking into my hat. So, you know, some of you who've heard me with lecture know that that's not the first time that ever happened either. Here's a shameless plug. So I'll have the slides posted on my website. If you go to Kutztown, I'll post these things down under my music page. But electromusic.com, again, is this forum, excellent forum. And I mean, there are people with decades of experience in this stuff, software, hardware, and composition that, that are more than happy to offer expert advice as opposed to flaming you. So if you want to get into this stuff, it's a good place to go and not be flamed. If you want to tune into the radio station where we're going out right now, and apparently at this point you can hear what I'm saying again since I turned my microphone, you know, low tech, right? Radioelectromusic.com is where that's at. There's a big event coming up this weekend within a 3-hour drive. It's just outside of the Poconos, just up past the northeast corner of Pennsylvania. And ticket price for going for one day is very reasonable. It's a bit more expensive if you go for the room and the board and the food and the whole thing. But you may want to check that out. Students interested in pursuing this should talk to me. And if you want to find it, just Google my homepage. So if you just Google Kutztown Dale Parson, you can find the link down to that music page. And the rest of the stuff is linked from there. And I think we're on to the last slide. And so I just want to summarize with a slide we had before. This stuff's all real, so there's no philosophical or aesthetic reason to avoid it. Now, you know, tastes vary. Some people like acoustic instruments. This is my 40th anniversary of playing the 5-string banjo, and it's also my 40th anniversary of programming digital computers. I didn't start to put them together until 2005. So for the longest time, my music making consisted of sitting out on the back porch and picking one of my banjos, you know, partly just to relax at the end of the day and also compose some music. But after, you know, what was what, 34 years anyhow, doing both things, you know, I finally decided to sort of put them together and see what can happen. So this is one of the outcomes of that. The real world, not analog or digital. So it's not analog of anything. I mean, it is what it is. It's not a discrete description of anything, but it encompasses all of that stuff. And so this is just all technology that you can manipulate for yourself in, you know, interesting ways if you're so inclined. And so finally, once again, make the machines extension of yourself if you're working with them and take ownership of them. So that's my talk for tonight. And once again, thanks for coming.